With the end of the year coming and the end of the century, it seems it's a kind of a logical time for a lot of people to reflect, to spend some time reflecting the significance of this juncture of time. And I think that this is especially so since, for me, since it's the year 2000, which is a very unusual event for many of us. The year 2000, I find quite interesting because of how it's a phenomenal manifestation of the mind. Those of you who maybe heard me give a New Year's talk will remember that often what I say at New Year's time is that New Year's doesn't exist. And that's a great relief to some people who don't like to party. And you know, New Year's doesn't exist, you know, and a wonderful thing about the Bay Area, you can go around to different groups, different cultural, ethnic groups in the Bay Area, and celebrate New Year's Eve probably every day of the, every week of the month, of the year, probably, because there's so many different calendars to be found here. There's the Chinese calendar, and the Jewish calendar, and there's the Thai calendar, and there's the Mayan calendar, and there's, you know, there's lots of different New Year's, you know. We just have to be one of, you know, many, the one that's the loudest around here. And it doesn't correspond to any particular, any at all, astronomical event of any significance. It's an arbitrary invention, convention of the human mind to say this is the end of one year and the beginning of another one. And it has some proximity to the solstice, which is, you know, kind of nice, but it's not that close. I mean, it's, you know, Christmas is even closer to the solstice, and they were trying to get it close then. So, you know, it's kind of like it's a non-event, except in the world of our conventions. And that's somewhat interesting, you know, for New Year's Eve. But I take it as a, when I give a teaching on New Year's Eve, it's really a way of pointing to something that is very pervasive in our human mind, human culture, is we often live in the world of conventions. And we don't see them as conventions. We see them as being something which is absolute or something which has some ultimate reality in and of itself. And one of the more interesting and more important conventions for us to really grapple with as Buddhists in particular is the convention of self. Most of the ideas we have about who we are as self belongs to the category of convention in the same way as New Year's Eve belongs to convention. It's a creation of the human mind. It's a manifestation of what the mind can create. And what's interesting about this coming New Year's Eve is that some decisions by a few programmers some decades ago, it arose in their particular minds, is now, you know, you can kind of trace it, probably even know the people, I suppose. We can kind of trace it to a few people. And the manifestation of their thoughts and their decisions, it has these huge repercussions now in the real world, of the experienced world. It's kind of like our conventions have this huge effect that ripple out from the mind. But it's very important to see the source as being originally in the mind itself. And when you look around and see many of the problems in the world, you know, we analyze history, we analyze political systems, we analyze the economies, and we analyze all these things that come into play for the big movements and the small movements of human history. But another way of looking at it is to see all the movements, most of the movements in human history, as being manifestations of something that arose in someone's mind, some decision, or some impulse or motivation. That most history is also a manifestation of mind. All the wars that exist today in the world that we read about in the paper can be analyzed and explained on many levels, but ultimately we trace it back to someone's mind, someone's heart, that was filled with greed or hate or fear or ambition or something that propelled the war, the aggression. So to look back at the mind, to shine the mirror back at the mind that creates the conventions, is a very important part of what Buddhist practice encourages us to do. And again, as I said, the year 2000 to me is such a fascinating juncture because it's so clear that something that was a simple convention has rippled out and has these huge consequences across the globe. Isn't that true? amazing to me. So this year at New Year's Eve, I don't think I'm going to say that New Year's doesn't exist. Usually I say that, but this year, with you know, it's like it's spilled beyond the mind so far that maybe I don't dare say it. You know, as the bombs go off around us. The mind made manifest. If there's anything, one of the candidates for the opening lines of the Buddhist scriptures, if you remember in the Bible, it doesn't open with, in the beginning there was the Word. Is that what it is? Close enough? What? There was John? Beginning there was John?
So the Greek word for word, I think, is something like conscious thought.
Logos.
So this is the beginning of the Buddhist scriptures, or one candidate for that. Mind is the forerunner of all states. Mind is chief. Mind made are they. If one speaks or acts with wicked mind, because of that, suffering follows one, even as the wheel follows the hoof of the draught ox. Mind is the forerunner of all states. And then it continues. And the second verse is, mind is the forerunner of all states. Mind is chief. Mind made are they. If one speaks or acts with pure mind, because of that, happiness follows one, even as one's shadow that never leaves. Mind is the forerunner. Buddhism puts tremendous emphasis on the role of the mind, of our the motivations of our mind, the cognition, the perceptions, the constructions of the mind, in the way that it affects our state of being, our happiness and our welfare and our suffering and our difficulties, and the way the mind then ripples out into the world. It is not, for certainly not the last analysis, the only analysis we should do, but the contribution of Buddhism, I think, is a very careful analysis on the inner mental or roots of conflict and of happiness, and not to simply leave it at the macroeconomic level or the political level, but really insist we have to also look at the individual level, that things are ultimately born in the individual. So the mind made manifest is a wonderful and a theme for the 20th century, because the 20th century has seen the mind manifesting itself in a phenomenal array of developments and the discoveries and technological inventions. It's a technological century in many ways. And the two images that are strongest in my mind, at least for today, and I was thinking about this, of the technological advances of the 20th century, is one is the landing of human beings on the moon. And then from the moon or from space, the photograph of the Earth hanging there in space itself. And this ability to visit the moon, to leave our own little sphere, and then to look back at it objectively, or look back at it in a way that we've never seen it before, is just a phenomenal step that I hope, you know, is remembered as one of the great moments of, hopefully turning moments of 20th century. There's also the nuclear bomb, which is also a great memory, great manifestation of the mind. What does it manifest? The invention of the bomb, the invention, the use of the bomb, what does it manifest besides ingenuity? So the moon and the earth. Ancient times in Buddhism, the moon, the full moon, has been the symbol of awakening. And sometimes a symbol of the completion or perfection of the mind, or the heart, or the universe. Sometimes an image of the purity of our essence, the purity of who we are. And one of the famous little sayings of advice that Buddhism gives is, don't mistake the finger for the moon. Which is, you know, if you're pointing to the moon and you think of the finger as the moon, that's then you're in trouble. You know, if you read a Dharma book, read a book on Buddhism and think that the words in the book are the, is your freedom, is your clear, you know, your practice, then you've misunderstood something. The books and the menus and Dharma talks really have to point back to yourself. And each of us has to clarify for ourselves the nature of our own mind. And what's fascinating about that is that what we're asked to see in our own hearts and our own minds is not something new. In the sense that we're not going to, you know, if we always want to kind of find new frontiers and new great discoveries and be the first person in the universe to discover some great aspect of the mind, how the mind works or something, or some great new invention of the mind or great new philosophy or whatever, it's not something new that we're being asked to discover in Buddhist practice, but it's actually something ancient. It's actually something which is universal, something which each and every individual can discover for themselves, but hopefully will discover for themselves. It's not something unique to ourselves, but is universal. The nature of our mind, the purity of our essence, how our mind works, how our mind causes suffering, how our mind causes brings about happiness. To really see the universal characteristics of how we experience the world itself. So it's not such good news for those people who always want to be on the cutting edge and get something new. You know, tell people around here, you know, I do Buddhist practice, and say, well, isn't that old-fashioned? You know, you have to admit, yeah, it is. It's really old. It's ancient. So this image of the moon. What was interesting is that, especially in Japanese culture, they have they adopted the image of the moon to the image of the reflection of the moon in the dewdrop. In the early morning, as the dew kind of drips off the flower petals, if you you can look, when the full moon is up in the sky, you can see the reflection of the moon in the dewdrop. And the Japanese took this to indicate that in each and every phenomenal thing in the world, even something as ephemeral as a dewdrop, there's something of the essence of purity, or something the essence of perfection, or something in the essence of awakening or freedom, or something really, maybe in if you use theological language, something of everything in its essence has some quality of the divine as part of it. So the idea being that you don't have to turn away from something, you don't have to reject the world or turn away. It's a matter of seeing the world in a new way that's required. So seeing that there's the full moon is there in every phenomenal thing, the moon and the dewdrop. And the dewdrop, you know, is a great symbol also because when the sun comes out, it evaporates. It doesn't last very long. So to see it in the impermanence of our daily life. And then I think, so there's the moon and the dewdrop, which is also kind of a symbol for wisdom in Buddhism, for understanding. And then on the other hand, we have now this image, the photograph of the Earth, and we're able to see kind of an image of the Earth from space. And it's a phenomenal image of this seemingly fragile, beautiful planet, very still and peaceful, kind of hanging there in this great empty stillness of the space. And seemingly so alone in this great cosmos. And there's a sense that when we look at it that you don't see the national borders. You don't see so much of what people fight over. But what you see is what you can see is a kind of this interdependent planet where so much of it functions together as a whole, the weather and the oceans and the atmosphere. So we now have the ability to see the world. And some people claim that in seeing that image, I mean, it's transformed who they are. I think one of the astronauts says that he had a great spiritual awakening was actually being in space looking back at the Earth, and it changed his life forever. So the moon and the dewdrop. But when I look at that image of the Earth, the photograph of the Earth, I think that the image is incomplete. For one hand, it's incomplete because it looks like it's just hanging there still, peacefully. And actually, the Earth is hurling through space at tens of thousands of miles an hour, right? If you ever look at a sunset, look at a beautiful sunset, sun is setting over the ocean, right? You stand and look at that, and then reflect on what's really going on, and you realize what's really happening is you're spinning backwards at a very fast speed. As you're spinning backwards, it gives the illusion of the sun setting. So we're just, this planet is actually moving through space very fast and in relationship to the sun. And then our galaxy in relationship to the Milky Way is spinning even faster. And so like we're like, I mean, our cars are just pretty slow compared to how fast the world is going around. So it's kind of a silly thing to say, but what we don't see is the motion. There's a kind of maybe an illusion of stillness when we look at that beautiful, fragile planet. But more, I think, significant for me is that when we see the beauty, the blue, beautiful, blue-green image of the Earth from a distance, what we don't see is the rivers of blood. Phenomenal rivers of blood which have made up human experience on this planet. And it's, I think that it's easily arguable that that this has probably been the bloodiest century of any century in human history. And it, maybe that's partly a function of the fact there's more people around to kill than there used to be. But even so, I think there's been more carnage and more bloodletting. It's, you know, the genocide started in Turkey in 1909 with 1.5 million Armenians, Christian Armenians were killed in Turkey at the beginning of the century. 10 million people died in World War I. 79 million people were either killed or wounded in World War II. 20 million Russians were killed in 2 years of World War II. Isn't that amazing? 20 million? And it continues, you know, the bloodletting, just endless flow of blood. So the moon in the dewdrop and the earth in the teardrop. And that's the image I have of the 20th century. These two images, the moon in the dewdrop and the earth in the teardrop. And these are the two great wings of Buddhist practice, the wings of wisdom and the wing of compassion. And both of them are needed. There has to be some seeing that not only the beauty, not only the pure essence of the mind and the possibility of freedom, but there has to be seen as part of that, there has to be seen the tremendous suffering of the world, the personal suffering, the universal suffering, and to see it wisely, and to see it with compassion. If there's anything that the world needs, that I think the world needs for the next century, it's compassion. It's nice to have more inventions and more wonderful new medical discoveries and all these things. But I wish for the next century that we have much more compassion. We're leaving now the technological century, and idealistic projection of technological century that it made for itself, one of them maybe, is Star Trek. What the future is going to be like, and all the little follow-ups of Star Trek, the Next Generation and all that. And I've seen some of those, and it's really fun to watch all the new technology that they plan for us down there in Hollywood. And, you know, and you see some of the sets, you know, you realize that there's, you know, some great planet out in the galaxy, and they're just filming there in the hills of Los Angeles. But what amazes me about the Star Trek kind of series is, in my, you know, maybe presumptuous opinion, how tremendously emotional immature the characters are on that show. They don't seem to have very good interpersonal skills. You think that, you know, 500 years of psychology, we've had 100 years now, right? But 500 years of psychology and psychological development and, you know, a few more centuries of spiritual growth and all that, and that somehow that you know, at the year 2500, there'd be much more sophistication about conflict and interpersonal problems and jealousy and greed and hate and anger. And but there's no hint of that, as far as I could tell, in the Star Trek shows that I've seen. What? Spock? they're working hard, you know, on data. So I think it's kind of interesting that we don't have that kind of we project forward technological development. We don't project forward the psychological development. And it's always hard to know whether one century or one generation is worse than the other generation. It seems like it's a common phenomena for older generation to be critical of the younger generation. Younger generation is kind of everything's going to rot. You know, and then that generation grows older, and they look back at the golden age of their youth, and now the young generation. So it's hard, very hard to judge. Maybe it's just we're all in the same boat all the time. But I think we have to remember the carnage of the century as we go into the next one. Human beings seem to have phenomenal ability to forget, and or not remember. To avoid its own history. And I think that one of the things that we need to remember is that compassion is born in proximity to suffering. That compassion is born not in the abstract, because it's a good idea to become compassionate. And, you know, it's kind of, you didn't do it. But rather, for compassion to be real and grounded and embodied, it has to be because we're sensitive to the suffering of the world around us, to our own suffering. And the challenge of, or the idea in Buddhism is that we have to understand our own suffering, and have to understand the suffering of the world well enough, so that when we encounter the suffering elsewhere, we see it as we see ourselves as part of it, we see ourselves as equal to it, or we see ourselves not above it or separate from it or looking down at it or the victims of it, but we see ourselves as we see that it's not any different than our own. We see ourselves in equal terms with the suffering around us. A tall order for many of us, perhaps, because to imagine some of the difficulties is hard. I think this room here is probably filled with people who've had seen great suffering, and if you haven't seen it directly yourself, you probably don't have to go around too far in your circle of friends and family to find examples of people whose living memory includes some phenomenally atrocious things. My parents-in-law are both survivors of the Nazi concentration camps. And I grew up in Europe hearing stories of people who survived the concentration camps, who survived executions. I remember one friend of my father who told me very calmly one day of being put in front of the shooting squad and being shot. And the bullet went through his ear and he fainted. And he woke up under a pile of bodies and crawled away into the woods and escaped. Another friend of mine who was he was standing in the line to be executed in the firing squad. And he was something like, it was like a line, you had to wait your turn. And he was like two or three turns away. Just happened to be that was the day that the Americans got close, far enough up into Italy, that the Nazis had said, we better get out of here quickly. And so they stopped the execution and ran. And it saved his life. And then someone else I know who went through the Japanese concentration camps. And this is a very touching story for me. Very difficult story for me. I don't know how to live with this story. Because he told me the difficulties he went through. He was in Dutch Indonesia. And the Japanese captured him. And his family, and they put him through awful suffering in the camps. People died there. And he was tortured many times, especially by one particular Japanese soldier. When the Japanese surrendered, they were released from their concentration camp, and their soldiers to guard the camps also surrendered. And they were going to be shipped back to Japan. And there was one English guard guarding this platoon, battalion of Japanese soldiers who were being sent back. This man I met with two of his buddies went over to the dock and waited for just the right moment and walked by, kind of whistling, walked by one English guard who was guarding this whole bunch of Japanese and pushed him in the water. And then went over and found the torturer, the person who had tortured him so many times in the camp. And they tied him up, tied his hands and legs behind him, and then pushed him into the water to drown. And I haven't met many people who actually told me they've killed someone. I met a few in my life who killed people in war. But that was the one that disturbed me the most. And I didn't know how to respond to that situation. And I carry that story with me to something to remember about how I don't understand and how I don't understand how to respond. Probably if I was there at the time, I would have responded differently. I would have known what to do. But I didn't know how to respond when he said that. I just got quiet. So we were to remember and not to forget, I think is so important. What we want to do is develop compassion. So we go into the next century, and I hope that we have great, wonderful technological developments, but I hope that in our pursuit for technology, in our pursuit for greater external developments and change and growth in our world, we don't become myopic. We don't forget about the source where those developments come from. We don't forget about the source where war and suffering and hate, where it comes from, and understand, but rather look very deeply and very honestly into our minds, into our hearts, to understand really how it works, so that we can find the wellsprings of compassion, of peace, of love, the wellsprings of understanding and wisdom. So we can understand how we can really be of service to the community around us, rather than simply people who take from the community more than we give back. I think it's a wonderful opportunity that we have so much, so phenomenally much social emphasis on this year 2000 and the transition. Because even though it doesn't exist, and some of us wish it would go away, I think it brings about a collective reflection, opportunity for collective reflection about where we're coming from and where we're going. And I think that it's something that behooves all of us is to, from time to time, to think about where we've come from as individuals, as societies, as cultures, and then where we're going with that, and what we hope will happen in the next decade, in the next decades, in the next century. And how we're going to contribute to that. As I said a few weeks ago, one of my favorite titles of a Buddhist book is the book that says, For a Future to Be Possible. And what is it that we can do to make a healthy future possible? How is it that we can understand our own mind? What is it about our mind? What is it about how we suffer? What is it about how we're afraid? What is it about how we get angry? What is it about the way we project onto other people? What is it about the way that we hold ourselves and see ourselves, our self-identity, that causes more divisiveness in the world? It's one of the other phenomenal aspects of the technological age is all the different ways in which we now can connect better with people. It's the age of connection, right? There's 100 years ago, no one had ever been in an airplane, and now we fly all the time. Many of us, and connect, and the telephone, hardly anyone had it 100 years ago, and faxes, and email, and all these different ways that we can connect. And it seems that the same culture that has this phenomenal ability to connect also has the greatest problem of alienation. Is there a connection between the two? Is the promise of increasing connection, technological connection, you know, is that promise of greater interconnectedness that comes from the internet, for example, Is it something we'll take advantage of so there can be real connection, real intimacy, real knowing of each other? Or will it be one more way in which technology has helped us become more alienated from each other, more separate from each other? So if we look at Buddhist spirituality and what Buddhist spirituality has to offer, or what it suggests, is that we each of us have to look in ourselves and understand ourselves really well and transform ourselves. And if we understand ourselves really well, then we'll understand the world around us from a very different perspective. To sit and meet ourselves, to sit quietly and meditate, and have a phenomenally deep confrontation with ourselves. So we see that what's universally true about ourselves. In this same book, the Dhammapada, the third and fourth verse. He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who harbor such thoughts, hatred is not appeased. She abused me, she beat me, she defeated me, she robbed me. In those who do not harbor such thoughts, hatred is appeased. Hatred never ceases through hatred in this world. Through love alone does hatred cease. This is an eternal law. This is the eternal law. So to understand what is eternal and timeless is part of what we're asked to do in Buddhist practice. So the year 2000, the New Year's, is a collective time. We share the same convention. And I wish that for all of you that that in that we're sharing one convention, we have it in common, it becomes the shared convention can be a bridge for all of us to connect with each other more fully. That we can use the bridge of our shared conventions not as ways of alienating ourselves or confusing ourselves, but as an excuse to reach out to other people and say hello and be compassionate and kind and look at ourselves and try to bring something new to the next century. So thank you for listening to my reflections, and I wish you all a wonderful New Year's.